now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
You're not recording this.
Dean Haglund, welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hey, thanks, Phil Lairness. How are you?
What is this story you have about North Bend, Washington?
Well, exactly. Like, how many times have I been in the back seat while you're driving to godforsaken North Bend, Washington, just to really leave your Twin Peaks fantasy? Good Lord.
And the truth is out there. People will see you driving, speaking to Diane that you have just entered the town of Twin Peaks. And, of course, they can see you at the iconic lodge in Snoqualmie Falls that was the Great Northern. So, anyway, but you're telling me, like, you have a new story. You're living in Sydney, Australia. How do you have a new story about North Bend, Washington?
Okay, so I go to Canberra, which is technically the capital of Australia, where the parliament buildings are, to go to the big international improv festival.
Can I stop you right there? Hold on one second. What? Why do you have to say technically the capital? It either is the capital or it isn't. I mean, as opposed to in a dream sense, it's the capital.
Okay, yeah. So the capital of Australia is Canberra, for those who don't know. Not Sydney or Melbourne or any of the other cities that are larger than Canberra, but don't have the parliament buildings there. Hence why it's the capital. So I was at the capital, Canberra, for the big improv festival called Improvention, where many of the likes of Joe Bill and David Rozowski have come to perform, and it's going on right now as we speak. And who's there but someone who's teaching the work of Viola Spolin, but Mr. Gary Schwartz. And Gary Schwartz has an improv group that he runs out of the Masonic Lodge at North Bend, Washington.
And right, I'm liking behind, where this is heading.
Yeah, right behind the restaurant where we ate pie. Damn good pie. So had we stayed in North Bend on a Friday night, we could have watched and or I could have performed with the local improv group there right across from that theater that you will one day want to take over and show your obscure favorite movie collection.
You know, the Twin Peaks revival had their poster released, and you know, the special 18 episode run that's coming to Showtime.
Right.
And it's so cool because it's iconic artwork, an owl flying, and the words, 25 years later, it is happening again.
So Gary Schwartz is now traveling the world teaching improv classes and workshops. And so he was there, and we talked at some length at the after party, which was held in my hotel room.
Well, so does that mean when you were in the peg, as nobody other than you calls it,
and even I don't really call it,
in early September, for the special show commemorating your dad's birthday, does that mean you're going to drop down into the Continental 48 to perform at Twin Peaks Improv Theater?
If only that were true. Unfortunately, time forbids me, for I have a show the very next day back in Sydney. So
wait a minute. I thought you were coming to LA for a tour.
Oh, yeah. No, that's oh, you're right. So I come, right. I fly from Winnipeg to LA. I do a one walking tour for those who want still to join. There's still space available September 7th in the afternoon. And then I fly immediately to get back to Sydney to do a show that weekend starting the 8th.
All right. I don't want to go down the Twin Peaks rabbit hole on this because we have too much to cover and we have plenty of time to do that in the weeks and months to come. Of course, David right. Duchovny is reprising his role in the Twin Peaks revival. So many of my good friends are in the show. I may even be cooking up a short-term run of a weekly podcast to affiliate with this one that analyzes each and every new episode.
Wow.
So there's so much more to talk about on this in the weeks to come. But let's get started with a very nice note from a listener that came to us a couple weeks ago, and I hadn't gotten around to reading, but I wanted to do so.
Okay.
Phil and Dean.
That's us.
I haven't checked in for a while, so I thought I would give you an update on my degree. I told you that I was preparing for my PhD exams a couple of years ago in film and literature. Mm-hmm. I passed and have been working on my dissertation, True Crime Does Pay, Narratives of Wrongdoing in Film and Literature. I want to read that. I mean,
yeah,
honestly,
that's fascinating.
Yeah, I want to read that. And it's just another reminder. You and I used to talk about this all the time, really. And maybe we've become a little jaded and just used to it. But this is a very nice reminder of like how brilliant a lot of our listeners are and how they often tend to be into much cooler activities than we are.
I know. Suddenly, I think I'm just dropping the ball on cool activities. I'm not sure.
So I would really like to read that. He's finishing up revisions and is set to defend in September. And right there, let me just stop and offer my advice, both
right.
as a former academic, but also as a violence prevention specialist. The best defense is a good offense. Any good football coach will tell you that. So my advice is to go into that room, guns blazing, insulting the hell out of the people to whom you have to defend that dissertation. You know, go to if there's a male in there, ask him if they sold any men's clothes where he bought that outfit.
Use obscenities? Are you recommending obscenities?
Absolutely. Anything that puts you on the offense and them on the defense, and I think you'll do fine. You can thank me later.
Sure.
In my dissertation, I'm looking at cultural crime trends throughout the 20th century and analyzing how they affect the development of crime literature and film. How interesting, right? He goes into really into detail, and I'm not going to share this now, though if anybody wants to write me and learn more about this this man's dissertation, it's it would be my pleasure to share that information.
Yeah, but, I would like that.
But I bring this up not only because we do like to read our emails from listeners, but also because I was going through not a hard time. That's not right. But let's face it, there are some days where what's going on in the world and what's going on with your own work, you sometimes want to throw up your hands and just say, you know, why do I bother? You know,
why?
There's just
yes.
that occasional feeling.
Despair.
Right? Yes.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I share in my acting class a lot with people is, you know, this idea, this old adage, I did not come up with this. This is from a far more sage mind than my own. But it's basically the idea that if your art affects and changes only one person, then it's worthwhile, provided that one person is yourself. Right? And that's the thing that I often need to be reminded of is, yeah, it's changing myself. I'm learning. I'm exploring. And that's the point of this. And so right. sometimes when I don't feel that I'm in connection with other people through it, I've got to remember that that sense of isolation and loneliness might in fact be bringing me closer to everyone else on this planet than my moments of triumph, right? Because right. everyone knows what it is to feel alone. And so, yes, it's important that our art changes ourselves, but sometimes, boy, it feels really good when just one person reaches out to you and says, hey, your stuff matters. And so when... young gentleman, Andrew Burt, wrote, as always, the podcast is keeping me going as I contemplate the effects of crime and watch an amazing amount of classic films. The episodes keep getting better. I particularly enjoyed the summer previews, the interview with Charles A. Colombe. I want more like that. And Phil's touching expose on what it was like to live in Los Angeles in the media storm that was the O.J. Simpson trial. Thanks again. Please keep changing the way we listen to the internet.
Fantastic. We'll do that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, it is true. And so thank you, Andrew. And again, I've mentioned this to people before, but, reaching out, it's scary reaching out and telling people. I'm sure, Dean, you've probably had experiences I have where when you want to, tell somebody whose work mattered to you that their work mattered. Sometimes you get it cut off when you do it. Sometimes the person is just not going to be able to receive it. But that fear shouldn't stop us from doing it, because you never know when your voice might be exactly the one that people needs to hear.
Right.
So thank you, Andrew, for writing us. We've got bodies piled up, Dean. I didn't think we were going to. I thought we were going to talk about one famous figure, and then all hell broke loose yesterday. So let's do celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Eli Wiesel died yesterday.
I know.
A Holocaust survivor, a longtime fighter for human rights, and Nobel laureate from 1986. The year I graduated in from high school, Dean. Coincidence?
Oh, look at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Yep.
Died at 87. So many more brilliant people than me are eulogizing and memorializing this great humanitarian. I thought I might just share a couple of my favorite quotes that I keep on hand by Eli Wiesel.
Let's hear them.
We must always take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented.
Ooh.
How's
that?
Wow,
that's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Wow.
The opposite,
rise to power.
The opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference.
Ooh.
Right? And indeed, Dante, the lowest levels of hell are reserved for those who were indifferent to the
evil
being done around them. How about this one? I like this one a lot. Friendship marks a life even more deeply than love. Love risks degenerating into obsession. Friendship is never anything but sharing.
Ah, hey, that's nice.
Yeah. It was Wordsworth who said that a friend is nature's true miracle. And I like this idea, because we've all had people we've loved deeply, and yet, the relationship for whatever reason may not have continued, right?
But that's laughter.
That old adage, marry your best friend. There's so much wisdom in that. The relationships that last the longer are with friends, and that's why we remain humbly your friends in podcasting.
Ah, look what you did. Fantastic. Good move there.
And finally, I'll end with this one. There's so many great quotes. But wherever men and women are persecuted because of their race, religion, or political views, that place at that moment must become the center of the universe.
Wow. That's a good call to action, too.
Isn't it?
Yes.
We got to send all our energy there. get all our eyeballs on it.
Exactly.
We don't often talk about sports figures on this show.
We certainly don't. Right?
Except usually when they're raping someone, I think is
well,
the,
yeah,
you know,
or, often we don't know who we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's when sports has entered the crime pages is really when we bring it up. But,
right.
You know, I drove through Tennessee, got to explore a lot of Tennessee recently, and one of the places I went there in Knoxville was the University of Tennessee, which is right on the river. And, of course, this is a very old and august institution. And for much of its history, of course, like so many longstanding colleges in this country, it was men only. For a great deal of time, right? Before it went co-ed.
Right.
And so I was struck at this Southern University that was male only for so long that the only statue I saw dedicated to an actual person, you know, as opposed to, you know, art, sculptures,
right,
and this, but was a statue honoring Pat Summitt, the women's basketball coach. The University of Tennessee. And this week, Pat Summitt died. Look, I didn't follow women's basketball. I did know that she was the most successful women's coach of all time. And at that time, second only to Coach John Wooden of UCLA men's basketball fame in terms of the amount of titles that she won, a record that's now been surpassed by the University of Connecticut women's coach. But so the third most titles of all time, and one of only four college coaches overall in either men's or women's to amass 1,000 wins. She won two Olympic gold medals, gold as head coach of the 1984 U.S. women's basketball team, and a silver medal as a player on the 1976 team. She was named the Naismith Basketball Coach of the Century in 2000. In 2009, the Sporting News placed her at number 11 on its list of the 50 greatest coaches of all time in any sport. She was the only woman on that list.
Wow.
In 38 years as coach, they never had a losing season. In 2012, she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Barack Obama and received the Arthur Ashe Courage Award in 2012. She wrote three books, including a motivational book, Reach for the Summit, which is a play on her last name. Her most recent book was Sum It Up, which covered her life experiences, including the past several years after she was diagnosed and living with Alzheimer's. There's all her sports credentials. There's her literary credentials. Again, so many people have eulogized her better than I could, but I read one thing that I really, really wanted to share. And this, I think, summed up as best as any one sentence probably could, how much she meant to so many women, both as a teacher and as someone who broke through glass ceilings, broke through barriers, and opened doors for women in all range of endeavors. And the quote was, "There will never be another Pat Summitt because Pat Summitt made sure there wouldn't need to be."
Wow. Love that quote.
Yeah, that's a hell of a tribute to someone.
Yeah, I'll say.
Now, turning back to the world of show business, because as sad as it is that Pat Summitt died, it's always so much sadder when a show business person dies.
As you say.
Hey, happy Canada Day, by the way.
Hey, right on. Happy 4th of July Day.
Thank you. Thank you. It is Independence Day, and we wish everyone here in the States a happy Independence Day. We wish everyone in Canada a happy Canada Day, and the rest of the world, fuck yourself.
Don't kid yourself.
No,
well, no,
what?
There's election day here, which is mandatory, and that comes with a sizzle where they grill sausages. So after you vote mandatorily, you get a lovely sausage on a grill.
We're choosing between two of those in the presidential election. I don't even know what that means. I don't know. I don't know what that means.
It's kind of funny, yeah. But I'm not sure exactly how that
works.
And
one of them is orange. Okay. So two filmmakers died yesterday. Robin Hardy, 86, who was most famous for directing The Wicker Man. And I'd been thinking of this movie for a while because we've been threatening that someday we'll do a theme show about our all-time favorite horror films. And I was thinking The Wicker Man might be one I need to rewatch.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be... I haven't seen that, I think, since late night television. Good Lord, The Wicker Man.
Yeah, I think the first time I saw it was on late night television, and it is darn disturbing.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
What did I come across?
I know.
Anyway, Robin Hardy was an English author, as I mentioned, a film director. Seriously, his most famous work was The Wicker Man. He only did a couple of other films. His last project was a film adaptation of his novel Cowboys for Christ, which was retitled The Wicker Tree. Gee, do you think they were trying to play up?
A little marketing?
Yeah.
That's marketing.
He was born in England, studied art in Paris, began his career as a film director with the National Film Board of Canada, and in the U.S., where he made television dramas and was a partner in a film company with Anthony Schaefer for 13 years, returned to London, where he made television commercials. He wrote historic novels and was involved in creating historical theme parks in the U.S., in addition to Cowboys for Christ, he published a novelization of The Wicker Man, as well as the novel The Education of Don Juan. So Robin Hardy, dead at 86. And if you've never checked it out, do yourself a favor. Watch The Wicker Man and not the Nicolas Cage remake. Original with Edward Woodward and Christopher Lee, who, of course, died last year. And I think we may have talked about this film then, about how darn scary Christopher Lee is in that movie.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I'm sure you saw this news. Michael Cimino died.
Oh, yeah.
Age 77.
Which I was surprised. I thought he was much younger. But
well, because he made such an indelible mark and rose stratospherically when we were young, and then kind of just disappeared almost as fast.
The Deer Hunter was such an epic... mark of film.
Well, you know, his first film as a director was a big hit. It was Thunderbolt and Lightfoot.
Oh, of course.
And
how great was that?
Exactly. It's great. It's fun. But nothing prepared anybody for his second film, which is The Deer Hunter, which wins him, I think, 3 Academy Awards, if I'm not mistaken, for screenplay, directing, and producing. His next film, Heaven's Gate, which destroys the most honored film studio in town, United Artists. Great book written about the making of Heaven's Gate and the unmaking of United Artists by former United Artists executive Stephen Bach, Final Cut. It's one of the great books about Hollywood ever written. So many great stories. Of course, to this day, my favorite is... that Heaven's Gate, which told the story of the real-life Johnson County Wars, it was shot entirely during magic hour.
I know. So you only had basically 2 hours before sunset and 2 hours after
sunrise. We call
it
magic hour, but it's really, from a filmmaking standpoint, it's 15 minutes. You have 15 minutes of usable light once the sun goes down, where the sky is still lit up enough where you have enough light to shoot something. So they had 30 minutes each day to shoot.
Right. So now how do you schedule that? Lord.
You don't. You just spend lots of money and lots of time.
Right, which is why it went way over budget.
Yeah. And a Western starring Kris Kristofferson that is on that budget. Probably there wasn't a lot of risk management going on. God bless United Artists. There wasn't a lot of risk management analysis going on that one.
No.
And
no, and I'm sure that decision was made on the day on as soon as they got there. I don't think it came up in pre-production.
No, of course not. And you know, it's United Artists got undone on both that and Apocalypse Now, both of which history, you know, obviously Apocalypse Now got embraced upon its release, though I don't think it turned a profit because of how successful, you know, how expensive it was. But even history has been kind to Heaven's Gate as a work of art. But, you know, these two films bankrupted the studio, and the studio was so guilty of falling for the sunken cost fallacy, where we have so much in it every time we, you know, somebody needs another $10 million or they're not going to be able to finish it, and that means we're going to lose our whole investment. We'd better come up with more money.
Right.
And it just
it's,
dug a deeper
hole. Your losses, and showing what you got and just editing together and hope for the best.
After Heaven's Gate, he still made four movies, one of which was marginally successful, though also not without its own share of controversy, and that was Year of the Dragon with Mickey Rourke. He did a remake of The Desperate Hours that also starred Mickey Rourke and Anthony Hopkins and my friend Shawnee Smith that came and went in an afternoon. And another huge flop, The Sicilian. I don't know if you remember that one.
No.
I think that might have been a mobster movie starring Christopher Lambert, if I'm not mistaken.
Really?
Yeah.
The one?
And then Cimino kind of faded away into oblivion. I didn't even hear of his last film and didn't bother to write down what the title was.
Wow. Well, there you go.
Yeah. So quite an interesting day seeing all these people leave us. Dean, we've been talking about what we're reading, and I actually pounded through. I'm reading multiple books at one time. One called one about the Mississippi Delta, and of course, I'm still reading The Comedians. But I read a book by Peter Falk, the late great actor Peter Falk, called "Just One More Thing: Stories from My Life," and it's not memoirs. It's not an autobiography. It's it literally is just stories.
Random stories that he's heard.
Heard or experienced or that often are answers to questions that he would get a lot. You know? And so as such, is it a great book? No. Is it a quick read? Yes. Is it informative? Sometimes. Is it entertaining? Of course. But there were a couple bits that were really insightful. And one of them that I loved was the passages where he wrote about Cassavetes. And
of course.
And I thought you would love this. He was asked what it's like making a Cassavetes film. How is it different? And he said, number one, the workplace on John's movie is looser. The set, that is the stage, the place where you're filming, is less formal, it's less structured. On a big Hollywood movie, there's a very sharp demarcation between preparation, getting everything ready, and the actual shooting. Just before you shoot, there are four assistant directors, plus their assistants, all yelling quiet on the set, and the yelling continues until you can hear a pin drop. Dead silence.
Right.
And then, and only then, the director's magisterial voice, lights, camera, action. On John's pictures, a lot of times the camera would be rolling and I wouldn't even know it. I might have John say, "Don't want to rush you, Peter, but we've been rolling for a while." That would make me laugh. I would say, "It's too noisy." He would answer, "Just start. I'll shut them up." And incidentally, this is something I might have learned on John's movies. I act a lot better if I've had a good laugh just prior to the director's yelling action. And it makes no difference if it's a light, amusing scene or a dark, tragic scene. The important thing is that I'm free and loose and available. What's available mean? I'm totally open to be affected by only one thing, by what the other actor is doing or saying. I have no preconceived ideas, none. If I'm laughing, I'm not remembering any previous insights or preparation. thank goodness. I'm not busy preparing. I'm wide open to the exclusion of everything else to simply hear and see the other actor.
Wow. That is fantastic. Holy shit, I like that.
You know,
so wait, how did he get around his sound issues then? If everybody's, did they slowly shut up once they realized the actors were acting?
Yeah, I think so. And when they were doing interesting things. And, you know, we've talked about this before, different approaches into the scene and like how Eastwood never says action. You know, it's always whenever you're ready, Gene, or whatever, right? Because he learned it when he would be on the horses, that the horses would tense up.
Yeah.
And he thought, well, if the horses are doing it, we're animals too. Of course, we're tensing up.
Yeah, for sure.
And when the whole name of the game, right, is to have your instrument as relaxed as possible, your body, have it be as relaxed as possible, even when you're playing someone who's uptight. That's fine. That's all in there. But you, the actor, need to be relaxed to what wants to come forward.
Right, to have these so-called spontaneous moments of naturalism come through. So it's not so wooden or, you know, you see so many of these. I've been watching a bunch of crappy horror movies from, you know, like all of those terrible things. And the acting there, everybody's so tense because they're told to be so scared that it's so affecting their ability just to act properly. So I think probably that's ratcheted up on set. Okay, this is a really scary moment. Okay, go.
That's amazing. I went to see at the Cine Family, thanks in large part to Nicole Hockenberry, I went to see our friend Lee McCloskey starring in Dario Argento's 1980 sequel to Suspiria, Inferno, a thematic sequel to Suspiria. And it was a big budget sequel in 1980, and you got to love Argento. Here, your last one was a big hit. We're gonna give you twice as much money. And Argento says, "Good, I will make it twice as weird and surrealistic." but what he did with the actors was, it was always about, "I want you so relaxed, be relaxed, be relaxed," almost like they're sleepwalking. And Lee was there, and he introduced the film and showed some of his artwork that he had done on the set of this film that was all about alchemy and everything. So it was a big influence on Lee as an artist. But he watching it 35 years later, he realized, oh my God, the way that he had us almost sleepwalking through this completely creates this surreal, terrifying, dreamlike sense of the movie.
Wow. That's awesome.
You know, and they're thinking, shouldn't I be all tense because it's scary? Right? No, not necessarily.
No. If you're a somnambulist, then for sure you are walking through the terror with only half your consciousness.
I'll just share this one other bit with you because I found this very inspirational that Peter Falk wrote about Cassavetes. John was very shrewd about money. He knew it was worthless. It only had one purpose: to help find a piece of film or a stage and try to capture life as he saw it. John had a vision. He wasn't afraid in the name of his obsession to make a fool of himself. And if, as someone said, man is God in ruins, John saw the ruins, and he saw them with a clarity the rest of us would find unbearable. But he was drawn to the God part, man's need for love. And he was always looking for stories that expressed the stupidities, weaknesses, foibles that get in the way of that need. Extraordinary people look at something and see three things. The average person sees only one. John would see 10, and he was able somehow to put them all together. He housed in himself under one roof all the contradictions. He was a man of action, but also a dreamer. He was teeming with feeling, emotional, yet extremely intelligent. There are revolutionaries who want to tear down and make something fresh. Then there are the old-fashioned, those who see the wisdom in the past. John saw both. He was both. A complex man, he had antennae like Proust, but he was a competitor like Vince Lombardi. He was a wild animal, but at the same time, the family was central to his universe. There are times when it's easy to be pessimistic, But if our tribe can produce somebody like John, there is still hope.
Wow. Look at that. How articulate is Peter Falk?
And sadly, now we don't have John or Peter Falk.
Well, it's true.
And I find it easy sometimes, again, to be pessimistic. Hey, you know, what we're reading is brought to folks by Booksmith Quality Used Books. They're at 338 Baker Street, Nelson, British Columbia, where if you mention Chill Pack Hollywood Hour when you get to the register, you'll get a 20% discount on your next purchase.
It's totally worth the trip to the Rockies. You don't even just have to look at the view. Go get some books.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's super natural British Columbia. There is no more beautiful terrain than that surrounding Nelson, British Columbia. So by all means, get in from the out of doors and look at some books. Wait, that came out wrong. That came out wrong.
No, that totally came out wrong.
Exactly. Come for the beauty, stay for the books, or vice versa. But the point is, the 20% off is real. Just don't go posting it on social media. Let's just make this be for Chill Pack Nation.
There you go.
All right. Hey, we talked about where you were doing comedy and all of that, but I'm still going to play the live event of the week because I want to ask you a specific question about some of your forthcoming shows.
Very good.
The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
If what I hear is true, Dean Haglund.
What do you hear?
You've been given several possible naming choices for your brand new comedy nightclub there in Sydney, Australia.
That seems to be marching towards the truth. I don't want to say it's a definite go. We still got some Armani suited techs advice that we have to collect and some permits and stuff that one has to go through here in Australia, the land of permits and councilmen that we have to march through. But yes, what's sadly lacking in this town of hilarious improvisers is a performance place for these hilarious improvisers to perform in. So we are, I am augustly working towards a space that can accommodate and perform 7 nights a week for a fantastic audience to laugh their heads off Monday through Monday.
I am not a betting man, of course, as you know, but if I were to place a wager, not having seen the list of potential names that were submitted to you for your approval, but sight unseen, I'm willing to bet you're going to go with one of the two following.
Okay.
Either the Ha Ha Files or the Lone Laughman. Am I right?
Wow. No. No, way off. The Ha Ha Files? That is terrible. That is a terrible list. That I don't know things on the list. Did you see the list?
So you did. You reached out to a branding expert extraordinaire Mark Hirschhorn, right?
I sure did.
This is a man, again, who came up with the name. I always sound like I'm telling a joke, like I'm totally full of shit. But it's true. He came up with the names like for BlackBerry, for Swiffer, for Dasani, for so many products that people know and companies that people hate. He came up with the names for so many of these things.
And people don't realize what a process it is. I mean, you know, it's like, oh, magically, I just called this thing the BlackBerry. Well, no, it went through a process and it required, you know, a huge amount of variation and testing and all that sort of thing. So I didn't want to walk in and name my theater the Ha Ha Files, for instance.
So I'm going to lose that bet.
Well, you know what? We haven't made our final decision yet, so maybe the Ha Ha Files will go back in the mix.
Lone Laughman. The Lone Laughman is still out there.
That sounds more like I'm just laughing by myself in a theater that no one's attending.
Nail on the head, is that what you're saying?
It's two nail on the head. As a stay-at-home actor, no.
So, you know, again, people may know Mark Hirschhorn from this show. They may know him from Succotash.
Succotash.
The comedy podcast. His book, I Hate People. He's forgotten more about comedy than most people will ever know. That's what I said when I introduced him at an acting intensive that I gave. But he was, if not in the news, certainly his work was in the news quite a bit lately. I don't know if you know this, but he's the one that came up with the term Brexit.
No.
No, of course not. Of course,
is that true?
Wouldn't that be, if only I could have sold that a little bit longer. Wouldn't that be great? Like, yeah, the UK Independent Party reached out to Mark Hirschhorn saying, how should we hashtag this?
This Britain exit.
Yeah.
Brexit. No, I'm afraid that's lazy naming right there.
So,
like Brangelina.
2 weeks on from the Brexit vote.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, look, there must be it at the comedy shows that you've been participating in and attending, and there must have been commentary. Any thoughts, Dean, about Brexit?
You know, this seemed an emotional thing more than anybody actually thinking this through. And clearly, now that everybody's jumping the ship, in the entire British Parliament, on both sides of the aisle, as it's so known here, clearly there was no plan what to do afterwards. So everybody who said we should leave got their way, and nobody's knew what that actually looked like or how that would affect
anybody. I don't know if they thought it was going to win, honestly. I think there's this degree to which we've seen this in Congress over the last, certainly the last 8 years, but it even began before that, which is it's so much easier to be in opposition to things.
Right. Armchair politics.
And then you get, you know, through the politics of divisiveness, which is almost always based on emotion, you're able to prevent things from happening. But when suddenly the ball is in your court and you have to be the one to now decide what is going to be done, you punt that ball away as fast as you possibly can.
Yeah.
Because you're not trained for that. You haven't thought about that. You haven't worked anything out. It's stunning.
It is stunning. It reminds me of the 47 attempts by Congress to repeal Obamacare. And every time it's been defeated, it's because, okay, sure, repeal it, and what are we going to put in its place? And they got nothing. So, yeah, you can fight all you want because this thing is whatever, blah, 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 but it has to be replaced by something. And if you can't come up with that, then the thing, there has to be something, there has to be a mechanism in place because, you know, it's called management. You have to have some sort of mechanism to make things work.
The stunning thing here is to me, and yet I guess I shouldn't be stunned because it's just the latest, perhaps most egregious example of this, but how people can be emotionally riled to vote against their own best interests. And out of anger and short-sightedness. But you know, and that's certainly been done here for quite a while. You know, in chaos, there's great opportunity. We've talked about this before. And the sad thing to me is that the very people who got left behind by this modern global economy of which the EU is part are the same people who are going to feel the pain of Brexit the most.
Right.
But there is, like I said, opportunity in chaos, and let's face it, it is possible that will there be hardship? Of course, it's already being faced, but a better system is always possible.
Yes, however, it should have been really thought about before.
I guess, but you and I have talked about this going back to like the 2007, 2008 crash, right? There's a lot of people And many of these are people in positions of power and authority that will not listen to good ideas until chaos has fallen upon them.
That's true.
Because we are motivated to stick to business as usual. Right. How many good ideas have you come up with and people said, well, that's a great idea, Dean, but that's just not how we do things.
Exactly. You face that daily almost.
And that's what ultimately led me out of the film distribution business, right? Because I was tired of having these ideas and people saying, well, that's a really good idea. But if it was such a good idea, you know, we would do things that way. That's not how we do business. And I would want to scream, but the way you're doing business is about to die. And then when it did, and I went back to these people with the idea, they said, well, that's a great idea, but why hasn't anyone done this before? Well, why is because you all told me that's not how we do business.
Yeah, exactly.
But they were listening to the idea. Suddenly.
A dog chasing its tail this time, not a snake eating its tail.
But the other thing about it that really, you know, literally struck home here for me, you know, when you hear so much of the big rhetoric about either how awful it is or how awful the EU is, and we took the country back and all these kind of things, is, you know, when I drove through much of this country, the USA, saw it the hard way, as I like to say. It was stunning to me how little I was aware of red state versus blue state.
Isn't that true? Once you're there, and I've done the same thing. I've driven from Tallahassee to Los Angeles along the 10, along the bottom, and you have the scenery doesn't change colors when you go to these supposed red states, blue states.
All I tended to meet were, you know, people who were often very generous and very kind. And, you know, people only identify with the divides, it seems, in seats of power and in the media, which I guess is another seat of power. But in real America, there doesn't seem to be nearly the same divide or difference. And in going through America, I suddenly realized, you know, genuinely the appeal of Donald Trump. And it's not the racism. It's not the hatred towards immigration. It's not the fear of Muslims. Those feelings might all exist in a lot of people, but that isn't the appeal. The appeal is, for right or wrong, a lot of people in rural and small town America believe that Donald Trump will actually bring jobs. That's what it is. It does come down to jobs. They think he's the guy to get jobs. Now, having placed their belief in him, he shows absolutely no leadership by then appealing to and signing off people's basest instincts and fears, right? As a leader, when people have placed their faith in you, oh, I believe this person will be able to turn the economy around. Then as that leader, it is incumbent upon you to appeal to the better angels of people's nature. Lift us aspirationally because we have placed our faith in you. Whereas Donald Trump is the sort of person who you place your faith in and he then tells you your worst fears, the worst voices inside you are the right ones. But it leads with people believing that he's the guy to actually get jobs back. Now, we can obviously have a different discussion, and it's not one for Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, about why that thought is nuts. But it's but it is true. It comes down to them believing that he's the one that's gonna you know, help jobs, help create jobs and
if it's just by building casinos in every state that have the Trump bling on it? I don't know.
But I avoided, for the most part, I avoided Trump jokes in this little conversation there. But anyway, you know, here's the other thing. You know, in driving through the country, very few even political signs did I ever see. You know,
oh, is that right?
In L.A., I'll see a lot more. But I didn't see bumper stickers. I didn't see signs on people's front lawns. I didn't see these things. You know, it was
non-existent.
What I did see, and I think I alluded to this to you before a couple weeks back, what I did see was an America where the Civil War is still being fought.
Oh, yes.
And it's not a war about slavery or racism. It's a war about federal authority versus states' rights. It is about what kind of republic do we want to have. And I asked that of some friends, right, when I was there. And very interesting stories came out about this from people in a wide variety of fields. I guess, you know, we just did live events of the week. Last night at the Hollywood Bowl was the very final Prairie Home Companion for Garrison Keillor. After 43 years, he's retired.
Oh.
And, but he was talking about how, you know, he actually spoke to this point in an interview where he said, you know, the battle that waged over these issues surrounding the Civil War are something that generationally need to be battled over. Hopefully, we learn not to do it through violence, right?
Right.
But they are important issues that need to be constantly revisited.
We did revisit it before the Civil War. I mean, there were technically a previous coalition of states before the United States of America, and the states had too many rights.
The Confederate, Articles of, what was, oh my gosh, I can't believe
it. Yeah, I can't remember.
But you're absolutely right. The Constitution of the U.S. was not drafted until 1789. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Technically, there were eight presidents before President Washington.
Washington, absolutely. You're right.
Yeah.
But these do need to get revisited each time, and we're seeing those very issues, are we not, now visited upon, for example, the voters in the UK.
Right. Yeah. This is states' rights versus the European Union right to tell them their cucumbers can't be curly
and,
or whatever.
And of course they need to be revisited because there's a global economy now. There are multinational corporations, right? So the playing field changes, but the issues very much remain and constantly have to be revisited. So it's fascinating to me. And, you know, one thing that Garrison Keillor always did when he would go and do these live performances of Prairie Home Companion, twice a show, he would just wander out. Like, imagine how big the Hollywood Bowl is or the Greek Theater. He would wander out all the way to the back just during intermission or before the show began. He would be doing this, wandering and just a cappella singing to himself songs like Battle Hymn of the Republic. And before long, entire sections of the audience are singing along with him. And he was asked, why do you do this? Is it, you know, and he said, what's fascinating, it's somewhat scary. It's always scary because they're always following me with a spotlight. And so it's right in my eyes and I can't see anyone. But I hear all these people all around me. And before long, they're joining me in song. And why I love it is I'm constantly reminded that no matter how much you might hear how divided we are still a united. And you hear all these disparate voices coming together to sing these songs, and you realize these songs express issues that matter and will always matter, and we can sing about them together. So I thought that was really quite hopeful. And
that's quite hopeful indeed.
So I'm sad to hear a statesman like that leaving, but I'm glad for him because, you know, the reason he's leaving at 73 years young is because he's tired of curating a show that has not offered him the opportunity to invent anything in a long time. He wants to spend his time inventing new forms and new things. So good for him. And
good for him.
It's interesting. I would tell people that I'd become a fan of the show, and they were a little bit surprised sometimes. Yeah. I like what Ira Glass, the creator and host of This American Life, said about Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion. He said, people who don't listen to his show much think it's homespun, old-timey stories. They don't hear the variety and dark emotion and ambition in what he's doing. It's like they buy the packaging without noticing the complicated product he's actually making. Prairie Home Companion is a very, very sly show. And right down to the fact that one of the most famous sequences in it, his news from Lake Wobegon.
Right.
Each and every week. Totally unscripted, Dean Haglund.
What? No way.
Totally unscripted. Yes, he had created so long ago a world and characters in his mind that he would be able to just spin a yarn out of them.
Come on. You telling me all those letters and they had a perfect story arc and all of that was all just improvised?
Yes, I'm telling you that, Dean Haglund.
Holy crap. I got to go back and listen to all of those again.
Hey, we really won't have a chance to get to movies this week. So maybe next week we'll talk about a whole bunch of movies that we've seen. We'll break down the summer movie season or what you would call the winter movie season. But Hollywood's right. Blockbuster season.
Right. And comes in the winter here.
And discuss all that. And I am eager to talk more about horror films. I've been seeing these like crazy. But I wanted to hit you with two things. First of all,
okay.
I rewatched one of the most underrated and little known Billy Wilder films, Ace in the Hole.
Oh, from this is with
Kirk Douglas.
Kirk Douglas. Yeah.
Yes. Remember, if Kirk Douglas and Glenn Close had a child, it would be Dean Haglund.
Yes, that's true.
It was 1951. It was just after Sunset Boulevard, and it makes Sunset Boulevard seem like a light farce, a fresh, breezy, light Disney-esque family frolic compared to how dark Ace in the Hole is. So dark that I didn't even bother watching the end of it. I'd seen it before, but I just went, I don't need this dark, because it was so predictive. It was so damn predictive of exactly where we would be some 70 years later.
Ouch.
Kirk Douglas plays a newsman who will go to extraordinary lengths to ensure himself a story that will get him out of the small towns and back to New York City, where he belongs, to the news desk in New York. And what was fun for me about watching it again and why I watched it again was it was shot in parts of New Mexico that I had visited on my recent trip. And like the movie predicted, those spots have become nothing but tourist traps. But it's so dark and so wonderfully predictive, like I said. Anyway, but there was an article in the New York Times, and I've been dying to ask whether or not you'd seen this. Basically, there is something called the Drake Equation, which is how we calculate the possibilities or the likelihood of advanced civilizations in outer space. And now we have been able to settle three of the seven elements.
Right.
And
because it required this complex algorithm, and nobody could plug in the numbers till we had the Kepler satellite or observer that could find planets and far off stars.
Right. And so it's about finding planets that are suitable for life and where civilizations could develop, and then the possibility that those civilizations would become advanced. And I thought it was fascinating because it more or less, the conclusion of it is, yes, there must have been previous advanced civilizations.
Right. There must have
that
been.
That the math tells us this.
Exactly. Which is what I've always said about life is statistically impossible not there to be life out there.
But, you know, I think the, you know, we just had a flyby ride of Jupiter, and one of the reasons that Jupiter is so important, right, for us, why should we care about Jupiter? Why we should care about Jupiter is, you know, those asteroids or those meteors or those comets that killed the dinosaurs, right?
Yes.
There would have been many, many more that would have prevented the rise of humanity if it were not for having this gas giant that is the dominant gravitational body in the solar system next to the sun, of course.
Yes.
And that it has prevented, undoubtedly, what would have been so many more, what are they called?
When mass extinctions.
Yeah, mass extinction level events. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's another element that people need to look at when they're looking in these solar systems and planets' distances from the sun and the presence of water and all this. Also, what about... do these systems have belts like our asteroid belts in them? And if so, is there protection for these planets? So it's fascinating things that we continue to learn right now about what needs to be in place for life to exist. And it isn't just the planet itself. It's the neighboring bodies.
Exactly. It all works together, some protecting the other. And they're looking for now... extinct civilizations. Like, is there evidence there was something there and now potentially wiped out by their other own doing or a extra outside space event that eliminated them?
Fascinating.
Fascinating indeed. Can't wait.
Anyway, that brings us to an end of another hopefully fascinating installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
That was fast.
It was. It was just a little bit more than an hour, Dean Haglund.
As always.
People can find every installment of the show at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Right. And why don't you write a review? I don't know why.
Oh, my goodness. Are you all right, Dean?
Yes. Right. No, I'm choking on my own disbelief.
All right. Well, write us, won't you, at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Like us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Please like us. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Just like on Instagram, we're at Dean and Phil. We post one photo a week with really funny hashtags. As always, we're brought to you by the good folks at Empire State Gas, and we are hosted by Blog Talk Radio. Until next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.